Hello, welcome to Pressure Drop, the program about the business of weather.
Good afternoon. My name's Ian Harper, and I'm speaking to you from the 4th International Conference on Energy Meteorology here in Bari, Italy. Right now, we're going to talk about the market, the energy meteorology market. What is it? How big is it? Who's in it? And to answer my questions, I've got two experts, Charlie Smith and Steve Dawling. Charlie?
Hi, I'm Charlie Smith from the Utility Variable Generation Integration Group. In the U.S., I serve as the executive director of the group. It's an association of operating utilities, independent system operators, forecasters, project developers, asset owner and operators, consultants, and some government and R&D organization. A very broad-based organization that looks at all aspects of electric power production and system operation.
Steve?
And I'm Steve Dawling from the University of East Anglia, where I'm a research professor. I also operating and running an SME called WeatherQuest, which is providing services to the energy sector.
Right, let's get started. What is energy meteorology? What is the energy meteorology market?
Well, the energy meteorology, I think, is an evolving field. I got involved with it probably 15, 20 years ago when we first started seeing the appearance of wind power plants on power systems. Up until that time, the role of meteorology and energy production was primarily the effect of temperature on load. We had a lot of very sophisticated models of temperature and load, and the forecast was always, what's the temperature going to be tomorrow? So we could figure out what the load was going to be and then dispatch very predictable power plants accordingly. Now, the importance of meteorology is being felt through the increasing amount of wind and solar power generation on the system. We need to know not only minutes ahead and hours ahead, but days ahead. What kind of generation do we expect from the wind power plants? What kind of generation do we expect from the solar power plants? What's the uncertainty associated with that generation? How much conventional capacity do we need to have on hand? How much reserve capacity do we need to have on hand to accommodate the uncertainty in the forecasts? So the picture is changing. The needs of the system are changing. New needs of meteorology, both regards to weather, predicting the near-term impacts on the system operation, and also climate, looking at how the wind patterns or solar patterns may change in the future and how that may affect the existing fleet.
Steve, what do you think this market's all about?
Well, I think the conference title is important here. Meteorology, by definition, embraces both weather and climate, and Charlie's just referred to the fact that there's sensitivity in the sector to current weather conditions, but there's also thinking about investments for the future. What's going to work for the sort of climate that we expect going forward? So I think there's a huge area here where providers of services can provide assistance to a wide range of players, as Charlie's described.
Where exactly is the energy meteorology market going, and where has it come from? I mean, it seems to me that there seems to be an intimate connection between renewable energy and energy meteorology, or is that not quite the case?
I think that is the case. I, again, look back 10 or 15 years ago when first wind power plant and then maybe 5 years ago solar power plants started to be a factor on the system. And in the early days, we saw rather small specialized forecasters that were taking advantage of some of the large National Weather Service predictions that were available and trying to customize them for the prediction of the wind plant output and later the solar plant output. And gradually, as the needs of the system became more important, the capabilities of the forecasters became greater. What we're seeing in the industry now is consolidation of a lot of the smaller players who have some specialized capabilities into some larger, more aggregated companies. I would say that the sophistication is getting better and better. We started off in the early days with very deterministic forecasts. In fact, I can remember visiting a system operator probably 10 years ago, and he was getting a forecast faxed to him the night before the day of operation. It had 24 numbers on it. And the system operator would look at this sheet with 24 numbers, which were the hourly wind plant output forecast. He'd say, That's nice. He'd crumple it up and toss it in the trash can. Things have changed since those days. Obviously, he didn't have much confidence in those early forecasts. And now we're getting forecasts with uncertainty bands around them as the amount of installed capacity gets larger and larger. There are people dedicated to just looking at those forecasts and talking to the operators about the information contained in the forecast so that they can make better decisions for system operation. So we've seen a real increase, I think, in the capabilities, the sophistication, and the understanding around meteorology and its impact on energy and operations.
What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I think there's an implication there of more and more data available to base these decisions on. I think a challenge that everybody's rising to at the moment is the sharing of industry data with service provider data. How can we hone the forecasts so that they are as site-specific and as application-specific as they can be, such that the trust is improved? You were speaking, Charlie, about improvements in trust, improvements in collaboration in these two sectors. I think that comes from sharing of data and people appreciating what each other are facing.
Is the importance of energy meteorology going to grow in the next few years?
I think it's only going to increase. I think as the power system becomes more and more renewable, as we get more and more wind and solar on the system, there'll be greater need for more accurate energy forecasts. And one of the things that we're seeing in the U.S. now is a trend towards some decentralized energy systems. So a lot of small aggregators aggregating behind the meter solar PV or batteries or small wind turbines on the system.
Rooftop. Residential rooftop.
PV, right? Yes. And as those systems proliferate and there's more aggregators aggregating these resources and bidding into the market, they're all going to need very local information about what to expect from their virtual power plant day ahead. So I only see a proliferation in the need for these forecasts and need for improved accuracy and very site-specific forecasts.
This takes me to my next question. Are the nature of the players in the energy market changing with the advent of renewables and the requirement for better weather forecasting?
I think we're seeing more independent power producers than we have seen in the past. In the past, probably 20 years ago, we had just large energy producers, vertically integrated utilities. In the U.S., with the passage of the Energy Policy Act of 1992 and subsequent amendments, we've seen more independent power players in the market with their own power plants. And we see that trend continuing to proliferate as there's more opportunities for different kinds of developers to get into the market. Usually the developers of the smaller distributed solar resources, for sure, wind resources also. They're more specialized and they're different from the traditional players. So we're seeing more players. And some of these players are bidding their assets into the market directly. There's energy traders that are coming in that are playing, you know, on the differences between price day ahead and real time that are trading on the arbitrage. There's the big independent system operators that need their own forecast in addition to the individual plant level forecasts. If you do your own forecast over a very broad region, you can reduce the error compared to the individual forecast. So the whole level of sophistication of the forecasting business is getting higher. I think everybody is kind of upping their capabilities in the game.
So, sorry, just one question before I go back to you, Steve. Does this mean that companies such as Con Edison and Tennessee Valley Authority are sort of the dinosaurs of yesterday? They're going to be taken, surpassed by these new entrants into the power generation market?
I think all of the traditional utilities are very aggressively scrambling to see what this new energy market holds for them, what this changing landscape holds for them. Most of them have unregulated subsidiaries who are very nimble compared to the old regulated company. And we don't really know what the new business model is going to look like. Many people think that the traditional utilities will become wires companies only. They'll own the wires, the transmission, and the distribution system. They'll be the glue that holds the whole system together. But we'll have aggregators, we'll have independent power producers, we'll have other small municipal and rural co-op utilities that will still buy and sell energy. We'll have traders, but the nature of the business is certainly changing.
Steve, how do you see the nature of the business changing?
Well, I think it's going to grow inevitably, as Charlie says, and one of the reasons for that is that we've emphasised power production so far, but renewable energy needs to be coupling more effectively in the future with heating and transport applications. So if we think about who the players are in those areas, those guys are also needing to engage with this energy metrology field.
So an integrated market is developing?
Well, it needs to. It's slowly developing at the moment. It needs to develop further. And if we're to meet decarbonisation targets and climate agreements, then we're going to need more to move quickly down that road.
Now, you run a small business, Steve. Are there opportunities here, big opportunities for the small business?
I think so, because small businesses, as we know, are agile and innovative. And in my experience, it's great to be able to work one-to-one in a bespoke way with an energy sector player. That's how you get your first break with the sharing of data. So if we want to demonstrate the value of a new idea in metrology, the key is to be able to apply it to some real industry data, a real industry application. So working one-to-one with organisations within the sector is the way to build that trust, to get access to data that you otherwise wouldn't do. And I think as long as you've got a good idea, conferences like this are great places to meet people, to throw out that idea, to talk about it, and then to go home and develop it.
Data, this issue of data keeps cropping up. Now, everybody needs data. If you want to do a business in this area, you need access to data. If you're running, if you're a generator, you need data. So, but a lot of data is produced by the public sector. NOAA in the United States, the ESA and the WMO and others in Europe and across the world, the public sector organisations provide most of that data. What is the state of public-private sector cooperation on the development and growth of the market?
That's a good question. We've been talking about that a lot the last 5 years, and one of the places where that's really come to the fore, and it was mentioned in the workshop this morning, is the need for private sector data, observational data, to feed into the public sector weather forecasting models, observations. What is the current boundary conditions at some location far away where they don't have any information, but maybe there's a wind or solar power plant that's gathering solar insulation or wind data. So we've had some very good cooperation between very large wind power producers that have tall met masts scattered across the country, under confidentiality agreements, providing met mast data to the National Weather Service to fit into their numerical weather prediction models. And that's also happening with the solar forecasters now, and I think it's a good example of the need for this public-private cooperation, which will only make the foundational forecast better, and which everybody will benefit from. So the data can be provided anonymously under confidentiality agreements. Kind of makes the whole platform better and everybody benefits from it.
Now, I've been waiting to ask this question. Mr. Trump has recently come in as President of the United States. There's a lot of talk about what he's going to do or not going to do. How is he going to influence the availability of data? How are his policies going to influence the availability of weather data?
That's a good question, and I think it's got some disturbing aspects to it, because one of the characteristics of the incoming administration is its climate denial. And along with that goes eliminating budgets or reducing budgets for a lot of climate observation work that's been done by NOAA and other agencies within the Department of Interior, Department of Commerce, Department of Interior, Department of Energy. And my sense is that lack of funding for some of those data gathering activities and even possible cutbacks in funding for some of the observational satellites is going to harm the gathering, the analysis, and the archiving of climate-related data in the U.S.
So Mr. Trump could impede the growth of the energy, renewable energy market, and with it the energy meteorology market.
I'm not so sure it will impede the development of the market. I think it will put a momentary hitch in our understanding of what the future holds and our ability to see the trends. But I think that Europe and the rest of the world will be very busy, hopefully compensating for some of the lack of data from the U.S. And I think that's only a temporary thing.
Steve, could you pick that one up? How do you see public-private sector cooperation here in Europe when it comes to energy meteorology?
I think you're right that there are initiatives which are looking to offset any problems that there are in the system. One good example is the EU's Copernicus programme, which the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasts is coordinating. Within that, we have a climate change service and a climate data store concept where critical data for this sector is beginning to be stored. And that store is powering new projects, such as the ESEM project, which we are involved in. So ESEM stands for European Climatic Energy Mixes. What we're doing in that project, building on this availability of data, is to actually look at the current day and the future demand-supply balance in the energy sector. So we're bringing together industry data in terms of energy demand with meteorological sector information and bringing those two into a consistent system which can actually answer questions about how balanced or how unbalanced can the electricity supply system be, so that we can realise what the vulnerability looks like, quantify it, and plan according to that for a better system in the future.
So that could stop the lights going off?
That's one of the main aims.
Right, okay. Okay, I'm looking at public-private sector cooperation. In a sort of a more broader sense now, the sort of availability of funding, EU national government funding, especially for sort of startup businesses, innovative ideas which might find funding difficult to get. How are national governments at the current, allowing for Mr. Trump, of course, how are national governments responding to the growth of this energy and energy meteorology market?
Well, I can give you a little view from the U.S. If you look at the budget submission by the president for the coming fiscal year, the Department of Energy is one of the places where a lot of that kind of work is done out of the Solar Sunshot program. And if you look at what the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy is looking at, it's very significant budget cuts from 30% to 60% in wind, solar, transportation programs, and those kinds of budget cuts would have very serious negative consequences on the programs. Luckily, I think that energy research and renewable energy has been a bipartisan supported activity in the U.S. Congress, and we're hopeful that the Congress will recognize the continuing need for good information, good data, good research, and that those programs will not be hit as hard as they are proposed to be in the president's budget.
There's more jobs in coal than in renewables, would you say, or the other way around?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Are more jobs in coal than renewables, or would you say it's the other way around?
No, I've been looking at those numbers recently, actually, given some of the statements from the administration. There's approximately 50,000 jobs in the coal industry right now. There's about 100,000 jobs in the wind industry, and there's about 250,000 jobs in the solar energy in the U.S., and most of the new jobs in the coal industry are going to be robots that are going to be involved with the dangerous mining operations. So I think anybody really taking an honest look at the job numbers sees where the future lies.
What about in Europe, Steve? Copernicus, I think, is a European-funded project. How's the funding situation in Europe?
Yeah, so Copernicus is a program which is encouraging research and industry collaboration to produce new solutions. I'd like to also give a university perspective here, which is that around the world, those of us involved in research are being strongly encouraged to deliver research impact. So the work that we're doing, we need to be showing what the benefits to society of that research is. And therefore, funding is following that encouragement for research impact. So we're finding that if we have ideas that are relevant and interesting for the energy sector, then there's encouragement from the powers that be for us to develop them and translate that into making a difference.
How does this work? Does the energy sector go to the university and say, look, chaps, we need to be able to do this, can you help? Or how does it work?
So the funders are actually setting up funding programs that require these collaborations to happen and to reward them accordingly if there is a convincing case that business decisions could change as a result of this collaboration.
Right. One question I've always wondered about, and this is probably a little bit to do with Britain rather than any other European country. If you have a power system which is basically owned by French government or German government, what happens there when it comes to the funding? Does British taxpayer funding go directly to EDF or a German operator, or who does it go to?
No, typically, obviously European governments bid into European funding programmes to enable Europe-wide collaboration. And that's crucial, of course, because we need to blend the best ideas from different places.
So it's truly Europe-wide collaboration, right?
This is where Europe works so effectively, to bring together the expertise and the end users at that kind of scale in order to deliver the impact that's needed. So the European funding of those sorts of projects has been crucial up to now. And I think Copernicus is very positive as well, because that's that and Horizon 2020, these programmes are actually making it possible for different types of organisation to collaborate. So it's no longer universities in different countries, it's universities and multinationals and SMEs and NGOs all coming together on projects to actually achieve more together.
Looking specifically at energy meteorology, just staying in Europe for a minute, do the national weather services of France, of Germany, of Britain, do they have specialised energy sections within them now?
Yes, they do, and typically they have user groups as well, so they will be meeting frequently with representatives of those groups to understand whether the current services provided are useful, whether they're being used and are making a difference in terms of people's decisions that they're making, and also, of course, to hear ideas of where are things not good enough at the moment and where do things need to improve. One area for improvement, undoubtedly, bearing in mind the growth of the offshore wind sector, is the need for more accurate wave forecasts. Because many of the jobs here in offshore wind, of course, are very sensitive to safe conditions when retrofit life extension can be enabled. So we don't just need a weather forecast, we need a coupled forecast that includes weather in the form of wind, waves and tides. If we don't understand that whole system, then we won't make the accurate wave forecasts that the industry actually needs.
What about the United States? I mean, it's often said that federal government is perhaps less important than state governments in the United States. I mean, the state of California, huge solar power programs going ahead in the Mojave Desert. Will there still be collaboration between the state of California and the National Weather Service, despite what Mr. Trump does?
I think the leadership that the states have shown in the U.S. in energy policy really goes back quite a while. We haven't had a really consistent federal renewable energy policy ever, and the states have really implemented these renewable portfolio standards, which have driven the development of renewable energy in the past in the U.S. until the prices have come down to where they are today. But at the national level, and for the weather service level, I think that NOAA and the National Weather Service are still the primary sources of the foundational forecasts that are used across the board. And they're very, very critical to the not only renewable energy, but to the protection of life and property in the U.S. because of hurricanes, tornadoes, and extreme weather events that we experience. So I'm hopeful that that will continue to be the case and that we'll still get the funding required. But to your question about the applicability of the National Weather Service's services to wind and solar forecasting, for example. 10 years ago, the forecasts were tuned to let you know, is it going to be hot or cold tomorrow, and is it going to rain or not? People wanted to know whether they needed to wear a coat or whether they should bring their umbrella. But that didn't do a whole lot for predicting the wind speed or the solar insulation accurately enough to do wind and solar plant output forecasting. So there is definitely a sensitivity of the weather forecasting bureaus to the needs of renewable energy, and a lot of work has been done in the last 10 years to improve the models so that they do a better job for wind and solar plant forecasting. And that's a continuing improvement, continuing incremental upgrade process for the models.
Focusing in on the energy meteorology market itself again, where is the smart money going? Where are the Elon Musks looking to in this? Are they looking at this market?
Well, I'm familiar with a slice of that in the U.S., and that's the result of a project that DOE funded over the last couple of years called Sunshot. There was a solar forecasting improvement project, and one of the two big awards went to a team that was had a large component of IBM in it. And I think IBM sees a very definite big data angle to the future of forecasting, whether it's training artificial intelligence tools to search through historical records that are similar to tomorrow's prediction to get better insights, or statistical analysis of a lot of different data to project the next couple of days. But I think that big data is the new kid on the block.
Is that why they bought the weather company?
I don't know.
What do you think, Steve? Where's the smart money going in the energy meteorology market? You know, what innovations are taking place, are attracting the attention of go-ahead investors?
I think blended approaches, this idea that we have what we call deterministic models that have lots of physical processes in them, and as Charlie says, they've been improving year on year, but we also need statistical models and machine learning to complement our limitations in our physical understandings. So I think that both in research and in business, identifying methods that can produce even small improvements, because small improvements in forecasts can produce big improvements in bottom lines for energy companies. So those small improvements, we need to keep going chasing those and blending different methods in achieving it.
Let me just pick up on that point. That's a very interesting point. And what we've seen in the energy arbitrage field with energy traders, they're willing to spend more money to get a better forecast next day than the average system operator is. And the reason is because if the system operator is off a little bit in his forecast, he buys some additional reserves. And nobody's ever going to criticize him for buying some additional reserves to maintain system reliability. But if the energy trader sees a couple of hours in the next day when it looks like the forecasts are off and there's going to be a bigger difference between his day-ahead position and the real-time prices, then he can figure out how to make money by having a better forecast and knowing a little bit more than the rest of the market knows. So he's motivated to spend a little more money on a better forecast.
If I could just pick up on that, I mean, we've all heard of foreign exchange trading and all this sort of stuff, hog belly futures and God knows what else. Energy trading? Tell me a little bit about that.
That's not my field of expertise, but traders take positions in the market based on day-ahead forecasts, and if they think that they know the prices a little bit better than the market does, it's basically trading a future. They know what the price is going to, or what the amount is going to be, so they translate that to a price for actual day-ahead compared to what the forecasters are predicting day-ahead. So there's a real-time market and a day-ahead market, and they have to cancel out their positions in the real-time market. So if they've got better information than the market does, and they knew that the price was going to be lower, then they made their trades accordingly. If they knew that the price was going to be higher, they adjusted their trades accordingly there as well. So it's a futures trading.
So this is how an energy utility will provide a fixed-price contract to a consumer for a year. It'll buy that energy in advance at a fixed price and therefore be able to offer it to the market, is that correct?
I'm not sure that they do it a year ahead, but certainly they do it in the day-ahead markets. There's contracts for differences I know that are used in England that I don't know the details of, but I think they hedge themselves so that if prices go up and down, then the risks are shared appropriately between the purchasers and the operators.
Mm. I think this is a good example of where an energy trader wants an edge over the competition. And that's natural. Here at the conference this week, we're also, however, focusing on how we can work collectively as a community to spread the word about good practice in energy metrology. So sometimes it's appropriate to be working one-to-one with stakeholders and clients, but in other situations, as we're describing at the conference this week, we want to spread that good practice. We want to explain to people what the latest capability in energy metrology is, so that people can go home and address those other important agendas like decarbonisation.
Do you have any energy traders here this week? Anyway, we'll bring it to an end now. Thank you very much, Charlie Smith, Steve Dawling. Thank you.